Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Toby Miller, sitting in for Ian Masters. Ian is in Australia for the premiere of a film he made for the BBC in 1968 that was shown once but then destroyed because it was considered too controversial. Fortunately, the director of the film recently discovered a print, and the documentary was reconstructed by the ABC in Australia. It'll be shown for the first time in 45 years at the Sydney Opera House on Thursday night. As for what we're going to do today, well, the budget and deficit crises in DC are on all our minds. Their local, national and international impact make for both water cooler chat and news headlines. Today we're joined by The Nation magazine's Ari Berman and University of California Riverside political scientist Martin Johnson to puzzle this catastrophe out. And then we turn to a wider focus than the Republican Party and a wilier fox than the Republican Party, namely Putin and his Russia. What gives? We talk to Daniel Treisman from the University of California, Los Angeles. Joining us now is Ari Berman, a contributing writer for The Nation magazine and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. He's written extensively about U.S. politics, foreign policy, and the grubby intersection of money and politics. Ari is the author of the book Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. And his latest article for The Nation is The GOP's White Southern Republican Problem. Welcome to the program, Ari Berman.
Hi, Toby. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. So, in a nutshell, what is the GOP's White Southern Republican Problem, other than a bunch of people who are stopping us from doing anything?
Well, I think it's the title kind of explains itself, but the problem is that the Republican Party over time has become much more Southern, much more white, and much more conservative. And that's a problem because it's pushing the party to the right in Congress to the point where they are really controlled by the extreme elements of their caucus that are heavily descended from the Southern states. So, for example, after the 1994 election, there were 69 Southern Republicans out of 233 members of the GOP House. Now there are 96 white Southerners, actually, I should say 98 white Southerners who are members of the House. So the number of white conservative Southerners in the Republican caucus has increased in only two decades from 69 members to 98 members, and that's a pretty significant shift.
But if we go back 50 years, if my history serves me adequately, when Lyndon Baines Johnson signed the civil rights legislation that included voting acts and so on, he basically did so saying words to the effect of, well, this is goodbye to the Democratic majority in Congress, didn't he?
He did say that. He said it actually, yeah, after he signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, he basically said, I've lost the South for a generation. Now, it may be that he's lost the South for a few generations. but it's interesting, you know, within the Democratic Party, there was a split between, you know, Southern conservatives and Northern liberals. And to some extent within the Republican Party, we also saw a similar split between Southern conservatives and some more Northern liberal elements. What's striking about what's happening right now, though, in the Republican Party is those Northern moderates have basically been eliminated. The fight within the Republican Party is often a fight between two sets of conservatives, more pragmatic conservatives and more extreme conservatives, the Tea Party wing of the caucus, who are overwhelmingly represented from the South. It's not like there's a fight between conservatives and moderates anymore because there are very few moderates left. So that's what we're seeing with the shutdown fight, for example, is it's basically conservatives arguing among themselves.
So if we take John Boehner's situation, he is the Speaker of the House. If he were doing that job in some other countries, he'd just round them up and threaten them. Why isn't he doing that?
Because I think he's worried that if he threatens them, they're going to threaten him, meaning that if he holds a vote where he loses a large number of his caucus and instead relies on a large number of Democrats to pass anything, which increasingly seems like that's what's going to happen, then he's going to lose his job because the quote-unquote suicide caucus in the House of Representatives, the 80 House members who told him that he better defund Obamacare or else – if he doesn't have their support and there's a vote in terms of who the leadership should be, there's a real feeling that Boehner could lose. He narrowly survived one of these coups already, and there's a feeling that it's really the rank-and-file membership that's controlling the party and not the leadership this time around.
That's very interesting. So in terms of what was always assumed to be the checks and balances of a separation of powers in the operation of our constitution, that doesn't really work if you play this kind of ideological politics, does it? Instead, you want supposedly the kind of relationship that Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan had, no?
Well, I think people thought that the separation of powers would keep the different branches of government honest. I don't think they thought that there would be hostage taking every 3 months when it comes to funding the government. I don't think that's the kind of checks and balances that people have envisioned when they drafted the Constitution. One of the things that's striking here is that because of the anarchy in the House, basically the failure to pass anything, the most routine of budgets, for example, and then because of the filibuster in the Senate, the requirement that you need really 67 votes to do certain things and 60 votes to do pretty much anything, it means that really it's virtually impossible to do anything in Congress right now. And that's why President Obama has been having so much trouble, because Republicans know this is where their best leverage is, and they're not willing to do anything without just an enormous fight. So once you think something is resolved, for example, you think like in 2011 we get a deal on the debt ceiling, or 2012 we get a deal on the budget. You think it's resolved, and then what just happens is a year later the whole thing repeats itself, but in an even more dysfunctional and disturbing way.
Right. Now, with the class of 94 that came in and the Gingrich Revolution, they had their disastrous comeuppance in their attempt to shut down the government, and Bill Clinton romping to victory in the next presidential election, and the Democrats doing quite well in the 98 midterms. That civilized or controlled or domesticated or did something to these people, at least to some of that cohort. Given the gerrymander that appears to exist after the redistricting of 2010, is there any electoral discipline that could possibly apply to these people nowadays?
Well, it's a very good point that you made up, because I think Republicans are really emboldened by the redistricting, because what they did as soon as they won power in 2010 in all these states is they drew the maps to their advantage so that they really wouldn't be under threat for basically a decade until the districts have to be drawn again when the next census comes out. You have a situation, particularly in the South, where conservatives are overwhelmingly representing these extremely white conservative districts. So they're worried first and foremost about a primary challenge. That's how they could lose the election. There's a very small chance that they could lose a general election to a Democrat because of the way these districts are drawn. So that's pushing politics to the right for sure. What's also happening is that it's just a lot more difficult to take over the House now than it used to be. There's a lot less fluidity in politics because of where people live and because of gerrymandering. So, for example, in the last election, Democrats got 1.5 million more votes in the House of Representatives, but Republicans had a 33-seat majority. And that basically means that for Democrats to take over the House, they need to win millions of more votes than Republicans, because Republicans are already disproportionately represented in rural areas in the House of Representatives. Democrats increasingly live in cities to begin with. And so you have this situation where, because of both of the population patterns and because of how the lines have been gerrymandered, you just need an enormous wave to be able to wipe out the Republicans. And I'm not sure in 2014 we're going to see that wave. There's certainly a lot of anger among people at the Republican Party, but the question is, will it play out in these specific congressional districts? And I'm not sure about that.
It might just mean bigger majorities for Democrats in safe seats.
Exactly. That's the problem. The question is, are the people who are outraged about the shutdown, are they living in these hard-right Republican districts, or are they living in swing districts of which there are very few, or are they living in already Democratic districts? And that's really the problem here. You have to really go down to the most minute level to try to figure out who's at stake. And I mean, I think Republicans on a national level are worried. I think Senate candidates are worried. I think 2016 candidates are worried about what's going on. I think certain Republican members, obviously the Republican members who represent states like Ohio and Pennsylvania, swing states, they're concerned. Republicans in Georgia, in Kentucky, in Mississippi, are they concerned about this? I don't think nearly as much.
I'm speaking with Ari Berman. Ari is a contributing writer for The Nation magazine and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. So, Ari, if you were advising the Democrats right now, God forbid you had to, what would you tell them to do?
Well, number one, I would say focus on those states where there's swing districts that still remain. For example, the Philadelphia suburbs. You've got maybe three or four Republicans representing seats in and around the Philadelphia suburbs. So, I mean, those kind of people are clear targets in the House of Representatives. I think you can get them. I also think this is a big issue in certain kind of borderline Senate races. So the GOP has to win races in places like North Carolina, for example, to be able to take back the Senate. I don't think the shutdown's playing very well in those kind of states. And then I think nationally, just heading towards 2016, I mean, you really have to kind of put pressure on the Chris Christies of the world, who are kind of in a no-win situation right now. If the more moderate establishment elements of the Republican Party, if they denounce the Tea Party, then they have a big target on their back going in to the primary. But if they sort of back the shutdown strategy, if they side with the Ted Cruz wing of the party, then they're just in extreme amounts of trouble when it comes to getting themselves in any kind of position for a general election. And so I think this is really, the whole thing is really hurting all elements of the Republican Party. I think that's why the president, although he dislikes the shutdown and it's hurting a lot of people, I think he's willing to wait here because he knows that, you know, it's the other party that's getting the flack. The only bad thing for the Democrats now is that we're having a fight about Obamacare and the rollout is going so badly for them that they're not really able to capitalize as much as they can.
Speaking of Obamacare, how relevant really is that? And what is it about the idea of essentially a mild intervention in health insurance that so irks Republicans who appear to be quite happy, most of them, to receive or to potentially receive Medicaid and Medicare?
Well, that kind of hypocrisy has been going on for a long time. I mean, you had, for example, the Southern conservatives in the 1950s and 60s who were just receiving an enormous amount of subsidies from the federal government. They were the ones most vociferously denouncing Medicare when it first happened. So, I mean, you can pretty much draw a straight line from the kind of people that were denouncing Medicare and the kind of people who are denouncing Obamacare. The point I was making about Obamacare was just that the rollout of it, the actual implementation of it, doesn't seem to be going that well, with people having problems with the website. And I think that is, to some extent, undercutting the momentum that the Democrats and Obama would have right now. If millions of people were signing up for Obamacare at the very moment that Republicans were trying to defund Obamacare, there would be a great contrast that the president could draw. Right now, he can basically say it's crazy to shut down the government for Obamacare, but he can't make the argument, not quite as effectively, not yet at least, that Obamacare is something that's going to benefit millions of people. I think he will be able to make that argument once the kinks get out of the program, but I do think to some extent the rollout has been less impressive than I think supporters of the law were hoping for.
Oh, no question. But similar things happened in a somewhat pre-computer age with the mid-60s medical reforms. And I guess some of that's inevitable, but I take your point.
You know how people are with instant gratification today. I mean, you know, you expect everything to work smoothly, and you particularly expect, you know, anything on the internet to work right away. And so I think it is frustrating for people. Obviously, the people that are going on to enroll really also need the health care. So I think the quicker this can get worked out, the better. But in some ways, this has been a blessing for Obama because the shutdown has really overshadowed a lot of the problems in Obamacare. So the GOP in some ways has done him a favor.
Yeah, absolutely. I wondered if I could pick you up on an earlier point you made, Ari, that interests me a lot, which is that essentially we're seeing two Americas constructed out of the two political parties. One is urban. It's either educated or working class, and it's multicultural. And the other is rural. It's generally not very educated, and it's not very multicultural. Have I got that right?
No, I mean, that's absolutely correct. And that's a trend that's really increasing. I mean, it used to have, for example, Republicans representing places like New York, you know, places like New York City even, which for many years had, you know, Republican mayor or it had Republican senators. And now you look at places like New York City, states like New York, I mean, they're just much more Democratic. At the same time, you used to have, you know, white, relatively conservative Democrats representing states like Texas, representing states across the South. They are now extinct. And so the extinction of both Southern white Democrats and the extinction of liberal Northern Republicans has basically meant that you can pretty much look at a map, put a pin in it, and figure out who's representing that district. Because except in, you know, the most conservative states, the cities are represented by Democrats. And by and large, the rural areas are represented by Republicans. There are some places where that's not true. But we do seem to be concentrating by geographic lines. And if you just look, for example, at where people want to live, I mean, you know, the Democrats want to live in cities. And that's what's happening in this country. And Republicans are in rural America, they're dying out, but they have a disproportionate influence in American politics, both because of the structure of the U.S. Senate, with every state getting the same amount of seats, and also because of the way districts are drawn in the House, which disproportionately gives a lot of power to rural constituents.
Now, what about the argument that this country is becoming more cosmopolitan, more international, more Latino, and that all of that is going to play out finally in the Democrats' favor? Because after all, Latinos, Mexicans, Central Americans are nowadays really throughout the country. They're not just in the big cities. In the last 5 or 10 years, they're in little towns in Illinois, for example, aren't they? And once those folks become, in a sense, normalized or legalized or whatever terms we use, they become potential political actors in ways that may be quite inimical to the Republican majorities in some of those regions.
I think we're still a ways from getting there. We're a ways from getting there because there's not enough of them. The demographics aren't high enough. You mentioned immigration reform. I think one reason that Republicans are so opposed to immigration reform is just for the reason that you outlined. They're worried that once these people that are here illegally, once they become citizens, they're going to vote Democratic. And I think for good reason, given the rhetoric and the policies that Republicans are proposing. And so, and I think there's some opposition to immigration reform just because they don't want to create, you know, 7 to 11 million new Democratic voters. So, I think we're ways down the road here. There's been a lot of talk about how demographic change, particularly by Latinos, will transform the American electorate, will turn states like Texas blue. But I still see it as something that's 10, 20, even in some places 30 years down the road. I think it's having an impact, though, on presidential elections, because you look at states, for example, like Colorado, like Nevada, like Florida. These are places that are now much more competitive and they're trending blue because of the Hispanic growth. So I think it's a big impact on national politics. In terms of local congressional seats in red states, I still think it's a little ways away.
Ari Berman, we've asked you to look into your crystal ball 30 years ahead. What about your crystal ball for the next few days? What on earth is going to happen?
Well, it looks like there's going to be a deal. It seems like there's going to be a deal in the Senate, and then that's going to get brought to the House. I think the leadership just had enough They don't think they can sustain this for another week or two. There's just too much bad press happening. I think they realize that they're not going to get a whole lot of concessions out of Obama. I think that the best bet they think is to fund the government for a while and hope that they can suck Obama back into grand bargain territory. Clearly, the president has a soft spot for doing this kind of deal. I'm not really sure why he's so intent on doing it, but he's on numerous occasions offered Republicans pretty good deals that would, for example, offer cuts to things like Medicare and Social Security. I always thought that those were huge concessions by the president. The GOP would be crazy not to take them. Now maybe Republicans realize that they're in such a situation that they will take these places because they can't negotiate for anything better. So I think the hope is fund the government in the short term, use whatever little leverage they have to get some sort of long-term deal that's more beneficial to their cause, but I don't think they can sustain this for too many more weeks.
And on the Obama side, that means there are two legacies. One is Obamacare, the other is Iran speak. Is that right? And not much else.
Well, I don't know. I think it's complicated. I mean, you know, you can look at Obama and you can say there's all these things he could have done, but then you look at the other side and how crazy they are and you realize how much worse it could be. So it could be a lot worse. It's not necessarily the best bumper sticker, but I think this is certainly true.
Thank you very much, Ari Berman. It's been great talking to you.
Thanks, Toby. I appreciate it.
I was speaking with Ari Berman, a contributing writer for The Nation magazine and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. He's written extensively about U.S. politics, foreign policy, and the always grubby intersection of money and politics. He's the author of the book Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. His latest article for The Nation is The GOP's White Southern Republican Problem. We're going to take a break for station identification now, then we'll be joined by Martin Johnson for further discussion of the shutdown in D.C. Martin Johnson, a professor at the University of California, Riverside.
I wish I was in the love.